there will be no end in sight to this horrendous conflict that has seen immeasurable suffering inflicted upon the men, women and children of Yemen. Yemenis have been knocking on all doors demanding accountability and justice. Member states owe it to them to take this forward at pace. The welfare of millions is in their hands.
Protesters are outraged at the ongoing Saudi atrocities in Yemen. They are calling on the international community to take immediate actions and end the bloodshed.
Mohammed Turi, Karachi.
British Prime Minister Boris Johnson coming out fighting this week. Not the contrite, apologetic Prime Minister a week earlier over Partygate, allegations of rule-breaking parties under his roof during lockdown last year.
Even though these things are quite damaging, none of them constitute an artillery shell into his bunker. So that's why Boris is still alive and peddling his pipe.
Boris Johnson's list of problems have grown bigger in recent weeks as more images and allegations of illegal parties at his residence emerged. The result, an official inquiry and a police investigation. The former by senior civil servant Sue Gray. The outcome of those investigations are yet to be published, but the scandal is taking its toll. Apart from the opposition, some members of the Prime Minister's own Conservative Party have called for his head. Others say they're waiting on the Sue Gray report.
Well, of course, we all want to know the story, warts and all, but the police are saying that it would prejudice a police investigation. And much as we don't like that, nobody's going to be able to stop them taking the line that they choose to take. What I fully expect is that the Sue Gray report will reveal more of the same sort of antics.
While some MPs in the Prime Minister's Conservative Party sit on the fence, the court of public opinion has already come up with a verdict.
If he's found to be guilty of these things, then I guess he's got to go.
He should quit. Very hypocritical from start to finish.
Just admit it and just say it happened.
He should resign.
That has meant plunging popularity ratings, a 32-point lead for Labour, meaning some Conservative MPs would face a near wipeout if a general election were to be held now. Add to that a cost-of-living crisis and fresh accusations of corruption over the funding of his Downing Street flat refurbishment.
It's hardly the first time Boris Johnson is having to wriggle through controversies, but the odds are very different this time. If he is found to have misled Parliament about those parties, he will be in breach of the so-called ministerial code. Saipur Rizzo, London.
North Korea Thursday conducted a round of ballistic missiles testing, firing two short-range rockets off its east coast. Analysts suggest North Korean leader Kim Jong-un wants to show his people he's their defender, although the tests have several purposes.
They're trying to make a point regarding the South Korean presidential election. They're trying, I think, to try to intimidate South Koreans into thinking, look, you've got to come to terms with us, the North Koreans.
Since late 2017, North Korea has not conducted a long-range missile test or a nuclear test in the hopes of making a deal with former U.S. President Donald Trump on sanctions relief. No deal has materialized. And leader Kim has recently indicated the moratorium on long-range missile testing and nuclear testing has expired.
He said that he might want to go beyond simply testing missiles, implying, not saying directly, but implying that he might want to test an intercontinental ballistic missile, an ICBM, that's capable of carrying a warhead to the United States. And he might even want to have another underground nuclear test.
The U.S. has criticized the recent testing, while China places the blame for tensions on the U.S. reliance on sanctions on North Korea. South Koreans will head to the polls to elect a new president on March 9th. With North Korea conducting six rounds of missile tests in just the past month, security, military affairs, and relations between Seoul and Pyongyang are likely to figure heavily in that election. Frank Smith, Seoul.
Shh. Shias in Italy, The Path of Minor Islam in Diaspora is the title of a recent book which illustrates the role, practices and ethnic composition of the Shia communities of Italy. The author is the Iranian expat and Palermo-based Minu Mishahvalad, an established academic researcher with a vast portfolio of publications on Islamic law and Iran's history. Mishahvalad's work was carried out in the span of 3 years in 13 different Italian cities, mostly in the north of Italy, where the bulk of the Shia communities reside.
A large number of Shias have moved to Italy's wealthy north for work-related reasons. According to rough estimations, they make up about 5 to 10% of the 2.5 million Muslims residing in Italy. The majority of them are from Pakistan, Iran, Afghanistan, and Lebanon. And then we have the Italians who have converted to Shia Islam.
Immigrants from Pakistan and the Indian subcontinent are very active in social events and religious rituals, such as the large Ashura ceremony in front of the Milan Central Station. However, also political activism is widespread, particularly among Shias living in Rome, with events organized in solidarity with the assassinated top Iranian commander, Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani.
To our Shias, generally organize more events and commemorations compared to Sunni Muslims residing in Italy. Another important aspect of my research shows how among the Shia faithfuls are today also a growing number of Italians. They have found in the Shia Islam a spiritual and political place where they can stand against the U.S. and Israeli's hegemony, where their traditional family values and love for artistic expression are welcomed.
About 2.5 million Muslims are living in Italy, making Islam the country's second largest religion. However, unlike Christianity and Judaism, Islam isn't formally recognized, meaning that mosques cannot receive public financing support, Islamic marriages have no legal force, and Muslim workers aren't entitled to take days off for religious festivities. Mishahvalad's research book also examines how Shia religious leaders in Italy interact with Shia religious authorities in a diasporic context. Max Civili, Rome.
It's what occupation looks like. U.S. troops wander around an independent country without any legal justification, invitation, or UN mandate. The U.S. officially intervened in Syria in 2014 under the pretext of fighting Daesh, something Syria dismisses as lies. The military prosecution in Syria held a press conference asserting it has collected evidence of U.S. Daesh cooperation in Syria.
The military prosecution in Syria obtained material evidence that the U.S. has almost direct control over Daesh and its terrorist activities in Syria using its illegal base in Al-Tanf. We have proof that many Daesh terrorists are being trained by U.S. forces in that base. We monitor the terrorists moving freely there with their weapons and vehicles.
For years, the U.S. has been looting Syria's oil after occupying areas in the oil-rich north and northeastern territories. The military prosecution in Syria vowed to judicially pursue the U.S. for all its crimes.
The result of our investigations into the U.S. violations in Syria, which led to destruction and casualties, threat to our sovereignty, theft of oil and wheat, illegitimate sanctions, and control over Daesh on territories of a U.N. member state, enables us in the near future to officially make accusations against the U.S. administration and its forces in Syria.
The military prosecution also accused the U.S. of promoting division by supporting a separatist ideology among the so-called SDF, providing them with weapons and ensuring they get all Syria's oil, let alone the U.S. airstrikes, which killed or displaced thousands of Syrians and destroyed its infrastructure. It hasn't been a day or two, a month or a year. It's been almost 8 uninterrupted years of U.S. violations in Syria, at least since the intervention of the U.S.-led coalition. But regardless of how much time they're planning to stay, Syrian officials don't spare a chance to reiterate that their country will be liberated from terrorism and illegal foreign presence. Muhammad Ali, Damascus.
Protests against a highly divisive bill have intensified in London as debates rage inside Westminster. The Nationality and Borders Bill has several controversial clauses which minority groups have accused of being racist and turning black and brown Brits into second-class citizens.
The fight over this clause is far from over. It remains in the House of Lords, who are debating the various controversial clauses which remain as part of this wide bill. Now, there is a lot of division to various clauses, and if the Lords decide that they want amendments to it, it will bounce back to Parliament.
The bill seeks to provide the Home Office with additional powers to revoke citizens' nationality status and deny access to refugees fleeing to Britain. The government have offered reassurances, with Home Secretary Priti Patel claiming the law would be used only in exceptional circumstances on people who pose the most risk to the UK. But critics find it hard to trust number 10.
Trust is something that needs to be earned. It's not a right for the government to assume that they're going to have trust from its citizens, especially when they're putting something in which is so vague that it leaves too many interpretations open.
Priti Patel is actually quite a disgrace to her ancestors. As a migrant, she knows that she came from the backs of those who were colonised by the system. And now you create a bill to oppress those? I think that's pretty fascist for me. And just because she's got a little bit of power, she's forgotten who she's made from, where she comes from. And just because she sits with some people with privilege, I'm using my privilege to use it to create a change for other people. What is she doing?
Having been passed by MPs in the House of Commons last December, the bill is now going through the House of Lords, where peers are suggesting amendments. The bill likely won't become law for the next few months, leaving plenty of time for further protests. Robert Carter, London.
Yemenis have marked the 40th day since Iran's ambassador to Yemen's National Salvation Government, Hassan Irlou, passed away. A mourning ceremony was held in the Iranian embassy in Yemen's capital Sana'a on the occasion.
Once again, we express our condolences to the Iranian people, our brothers, on the death of Mr. Hassan Irlou, who contributed a lot to the strengthening of the ties between Yemen and Iran.
In October 2020, Irlou was appointed as Iran's ambassador to Yemen's National Salvation Government. In that portfolio, he focused his efforts on unifying resistance groups and strived for national reconciliation. He encouraged Yemeni political groups to resolve their internal disputes through dialogue. The senior diplomat also worked toward garnering international support for a mechanism that would end the Yemen conflict and lift the blockade imposed by the Saudi-led coalition.
Everyone knows the stance of the Iranian people and the Iranian government, and that they stand with the Yemeni people against the Saudi-led war. Hassan Irlou was a great person. Despite the short period of Irlou's work in Yemen, he performed his duties to the fullest and contributed to the diplomatic process. When I met him in Iran, he used to tell me that he wished to visit Yemen, and thank God his wish came true, even if it was for a short time.
Irlou was diagnosed with COVID-19 in mid-December, days before he was transferred to Tehran from Sana'a to receive medical treatment. But by the time he arrived at a hospital in Iran's capital, his condition had worsened irrevocably. Iran's foreign ministry spokesman Saeed Khatibzadeh says that's because certain countries delayed his flight out of Sana'a. Khatibzadeh did not name any country, but Saudi Arabia and its allies have been keeping Yemen under blockade since 2015.
Despite his short tenure as Iran's ambassador to Yemen, people he say the Iranian diplomat played a pivotal role in strengthening the brotherly ties between Tehran and Sana'a. They hold the Saudi-led coalition responsible for his death caused by the deliberate delay of his return home. Abdul Latif Al-Washali from the Iranian embassy in Sana'a.
Stop the Saudi war on Yemen. This is what protesters demand as they gathered outside the United Nations office in Tehran. The rally came in reaction to last week's deadly airstrikes by the Saudi-led coalition that targeted a detention facility in Yemen. The United Nations did express its concern for the escalation of the conflict, but protesters here say it's not enough.
We gathered in front of the UN office to say that all of the crimes that are being committed against civilians are happening because the United Nations has given the Saudi criminals a green light by staying silent and watching.
For 7 years, the Yemeni nation has been facing the cruelest blockade and deadliest airstrikes, but no one is doing anything to help the Yemenis.
This time, besides targeting innocent people, Saudi Arabia also targeted the internet infrastructure to prevent their crimes from being reflected to the world. So we are the voices of our Yemeni brothers and sisters, and we are here to tell the world about the Saudi crimes.
Saudi Arabia and its regional allies launched the war on Yemen in March 2015 with the goal of bringing former Yemeni President Abdurrabbuh Mansur Hadi back to power. Yemen's Ansarullah movement, along with the army, leads the anti-Saudi resistance in the country. These people say, despite Riyadh's strong logistic support from the US and UK, Yemen has made headways against the Saudi invaders and left the kingdom and its allies bogged down in the country.
The enemy is facing a hard time. Saudi Arabia tried its best and plundered its money on American and British weapons to bring our nation to its knees. But our resistance has burst their bubble, and as you see, they are resorting to barbaric ways to achieve their evil goals. But we keep resisting until our land is free.
The ongoing bombardment of civilian facilities has left hundreds of thousands of Yemenis dead and destroyed the infrastructure of the impoverished country, not to mention the spread of infectious diseases and famine. Saudi Arabia has also imposed an all-out blockade against Yemen, which blocks the entry of humanitarian and medical supplies into the war-torn country.
The Saudi war on Yemen is slammed here as a crime against humanity, a crime that these people say continues to be ignored by the responsible entities in the world. Protesters here say it's time for the UN to do more than condemning the crimes committed by Riyadh and take action to bring the Yemeni suffering to an end. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Harsh winter, hunger, and poverty have impacted daily lives across Afghanistan, with children worst hit by the difficulties combined with malnourishment and famine. According to the United Nations Children's Agency, more than 1 million children in Afghanistan are at the risk of severe malnutrition and death this year. The agency called on Afghan partners and donors to take practical steps to prevent the catastrophe.
We work here to provide our family with food and money. My father is alive, but he is jobless. Some of us are orphans and sole breadwinners of our families. It is very cold, but we have to come here and work.
It is cold, but we take to the streets for work. We polish boots or sell gum and flowers. I have a family of five. Me and my brother are our family's breadwinners. We have no way out.
Here in Indira Gandhi Hospital, as the doctors say, the number of malnourished children has more than doubled since poverty is on the rise in Afghanistan.
Malnutrition has a direct relation with the economic and financial situation of the people. The more people get poor, the more our patients increase. As you know, the recent sanctions and aid cut have affected our people's economy, so we are receiving more and more patients.
The economic situation has worsened among all Afghan children. Our children are being malnourished due to the shortage of food and nutrition in our country. I call on the world to help Afghan families.
According to the UN, only 2% of the population of Afghanistan are getting enough food to eat, and half the population are facing severe hunger. Almost 5 months after the US-led international coalition hastily abandoned Afghanistan, millions of Afghans are teetering at the brink of starvation. The US and its allies have cut off Afghanistan's access to international aid and froze roughly $10 billion in assets belonging to the country's central bank since August after the Taliban took over of the war-torn country. The UN had already warned that millions of Afghans could run out of food before the onset of harsh winter, and around 1 million children were at risk of starvation and death. 20 years of war and the US sanctions have led millions of Afghans to the brink of starvation. Children in particular are paying the price of conflicts and crises in their country. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
the limelight.
In a victory for political freedom, a German federal court ruled that Munich's refusal of a public venue for a debate on the city's anti-BDS resolution was unconstitutional. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by Adri Neuhof Ryder. This article is published under the heading Munich Anti-BDS Policy is Illegal. German Federal Court Rules. Stay tuned for more. In a victory for political freedom, a German federal court ruled that Munich's refusal of a public venue for a debate on the city's anti-BDS resolution was unconstitutional. The city's policy violates the fundamental right to freedom of expression, the court ruled. The decision is a slap in the face for the Munich City Council, which adopted a resolution in 2017 barring public funding or space for supporters of BDS, the boycott, divestment, and sanctions campaign for Palestinian rights. The ruling has wide implications for free speech across Germany, where people face regular repression and smears from officials over their support for Palestinian rights. Meanwhile, in neighboring Austria, the Vienna city government is suing a member of BDS Austria for defamation over a Facebook post critical of the Zionist regime apartheid. In April 2018, resident Klaus Reid tried to book a room at the Munich City Museum to host a discussion about how the municipality's anti-BDS resolution would affect freedom of speech. The city refused the booking for what it considered a BDS-related event. Reid took the matter to court. At first, a lower court ruled against him, affirming that Munich had the right to impose such restrictions. He appealed, and in 2021, but Munich could not accept that and brought the case to federal court, hoping to overturn Reid's victory. The attempt failed, however. On January 20th, Germany's Federal Administrative Court in Leipzig issued its ruling siding with Reid. The federal court affirmed that German law guarantees everyone the right to freely express and disseminate their opinion. It found that the Munich city government was not allowed to violate that right by denying permission for an event because of the expected expression of opinions on the BDS campaign or on its content, goals, and topics. The federal court also affirmed that Munich's anti-BDS resolution is not a law. The landmark decision sends a warning to city councils across Germany that have passed similar resolutions and have been denying organizers of BDS-related events access to public venues. The ruling also has implications for the German Parliament's 2019 anti-BDS resolution, which, although not legally binding, urges German institutions and public bodies to deny funding and facilities to groups that support the BDS movement. The city government in the Austrian capital Vienna is suing a representative of BDS Austria for an August 2021 post on the activist group's Facebook page. The post shows a photo of a municipal billboard with a protest poster pasted over it, but leaving the city's official logo still visible. The protest poster resembles the famous Visit Palestine poster from 1930s, but instead it bears the word Visit Apartheid. The protest poster also has the city's logo on it. One BDS Austria social media post had the sarcastic caption, "We are pleased that the city of Vienna also takes note of apartheid and publicly states it." In November, a member of BDS Austria was notified that the Vienna municipality filed a lawsuit alleging that the BDS movement incites hatred against Israeli people. Therefore, the city claims being publicly associated with BDS is defamation, since the designation of the situation in Palestine as apartheid constitutes damage to their reputation, they said. The city is asking the court to prohibit BDS Austria from making use of signs which belong to the municipality and $4,000 in damages. If the court orders BDS Austria to pay the legal costs, the total amount could be as high as $40,000. The European Legal Support Center, ELSC, a civil rights and legal advocacy group, is calling this an example of a SLAP, a strategic lawsuit against public participation. Such lawsuits are typically aimed at silencing critical speech. The city's claim is patently ridiculous because it is apparent that the poster was roughly pasted over the city's billboard and is not an official message of Vienna City. Moreover, Vienna's denial of the reality of apartheid experienced by Palestinians flies in the face of a growing consensus, affirmed even by such mainstream groups as Human Rights Watch and B'Tselem. ELSC has set up a crowdfunding campaign to ask for public donations to help with legal expenses. And a petition supporting BDS Austria has gathered almost 700 signatures.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
Now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
When it comes to the standoff between the U.S. and NATO with Russia over Ukraine, there seems to be a key development that changes the dynamics. Now Ukraine has come out and said that the U.S. in particular is hyping the situation and has elevated to a war scenario. In this edition of the Spotlight, we will look at why the U.S. is taking a more aggressive stance against Russia and whether the U.S. reluctance to not meet Russia's security demands will end up in a war or not.
Ukraine. A country in Eastern Europe making the headlines these days as it remains a source of friction between its neighbor Russia and backers in the US-led NATO alliance. Corporate media have been trying to portray Russia as an aggressor, bombarding their audience with reports on the country's troop deployment at the border, its military drills, as well as moving blood supplies to Ukraine. Can the international community fall into yet another war trap in a scenario set by the West on a likely Russian invasion of Ukraine? But the question is, given the US-led NATO's eastward expansion and transfer of their lethal weapons and troops bases in Eastern Europe, which one is the real aggressor, NATO or Russia?
When the Soviet Union fell
and the Warsaw Pact had already been ended. Since then, NATO has added 14 more countries, and nearly all of them are countries that were either republics of the Soviet Union or allies of the Soviet Union.
Ukraine is simply a pawn on the Western chessboard. The U.S. has already sent several consignments of weapons as part of a multi-million dollar security aid to Ukraine while planning more troop deployment. America's allies, Britain, France, and others, have also put their forces on alert. The massive propaganda has even prompted the Ukrainian leader to urge his Western counterparts to avoid stirring panic over a Russia invasion. The West claims Russia is building up troops at the border to invade Ukraine. Moscow denies any such plan, saying its troop mobilization is simply defensive. It says the buildup also aims to counter NATO aggression. The military alliance has conducted several war games near Russian borders, three of them jointly with Ukraine, which is not even a member of the military alliance. So, what's the real game plan? Analysts believe the U.S. wants to integrate Ukraine into the American empire by granting it a NATO membership, a message hidden in Washington's response to Moscow's security proposals.
This makes the Russians see red spots before their eyes, the same way as any talk of Mexico, say, joining a Chinese military alliance would make them freak out in Washington. It's not a difficult problem.
Russia is seeking to reassert its place in the international arena, and its proposals for a diplomatic resolution to the Ukraine standoff seem reasonable. A possible military conflict between the European Union and Russia would entail massive human losses and economic harms. Undoubtedly, Russia has grown increasingly concerned about its security because of Western weapons and forces deployed to its doorstep. The corporate media have played a vital part in fueling tensions, and the U.S., that has waged numerous wars overseas, knows very well how dangerous provoking a war with Russia will be.
Our guest joining us for this edition of The Spotlight, representative to the U.N. from the Schiller Institute, Richard Black, joins us from Hackensack, New Jersey. We also have radio host, journalist, and political activist Don DeBar, who joins us from Ossining, New York.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Welcome to you both. Don DeBar, first to you. You have the U.S. pretty familiar with the stance of the U.S. at this point, very pro-militaristic in nature, 8,500 troops on heightened alert. They have told Ukraine, we're going to keep giving you arms. They just delivered I don't know how many hundreds of tons of arms based on the latest report. And then you had the Ukrainian pro-war president that I'm going to take on Russia changing stance. Of which his latest quote was, he said, stop creating panic. And he said, we don't need this panic. What is going on here? Is there a change of stance from the Ukrainian president?
It's hard to parse what things are real and what things are for public consumption, because there's a great deal of both moving parts in play right now. You have a pronouncement from Lukashenko, he's basically playing the same role that the Ukrainian president is playing, let me at him, hold me back, in other words, you have two paper tiger, you know, mad dogs that are your proxy, sort of like a 21st century version of Yugoslavia and Albania when the Soviet Union and the People's Republic of China would have a public dispute. These would be their proxies. First, in terms of all of the things that are going on, who's their hostilities and what's going on. There are satellites, networks in the possession of both sides of this that they've been using for 50 years now. They know exactly who has what resources deployed where. So you have a discussion, for example, where people say, okay, well, if they're going to put the troop, U.S. and NATO are going to put troops in Ukraine, and they're going to try to foment color revolutions, quote unquote, in Belarus and Kazakhstan, and you look at a map and it starts to look like Operation Barbarossa, because that's true, by the way. You look at a map of the fullest extent of the Nazi invasion in the early 1940s and where NATO is now and where they're trying to go, they'd be starting Hitler's invasion from the front lines instead of from Germany, which is the Russian strategists are well aware of this. Uh-huh. So people say, well, suppose they put resources in Cuba, Venezuela, Nicaragua,
right,
and then the United States, there's a huge outcry, we will not allow that to be severe consequences. Well, and then you have from Lavrov and Putin a statement that we are now reaching deeper relations, economic, social, political, and military, vague. So that stuff is for public consumption. The United States knows exactly where every piece of Russian and Chinese military equipment on the planet is, as do they know where every piece of NATO, et cetera. So there's a real game that's going on between the two militaries and intelligence agencies and right. the deep government in this case. And then there's this TV show we're watching. It's hard to parse which is which.
Well, one of the things that Richard Black, Don DeBar said there is the fact that how Ukraine can be, in a sense, a proxy for the U.S. I mean, we know that there was a color revolution that happened in Ukraine, but we're looking at how just in the past days the Ukrainian president has changed stance. Another one of his quotes, Ukraine's stability is of great significance. And he said U.S. is panic triggering alerts are placing a heavy burden on the economy. It seems like there's a diversion. Do you think there is one?
Yes, it is the case that President Zelensky has made the point repeatedly in the last days that certain forces in the West, typified by CNN, Truss of Britain, and others, are talking about an imminent invasion of Ukraine by Russia, which does not exist. The Ukrainian leadership keeps saying it does not exist. The Russian leadership has said it does not exist. So something very nasty and dangerous is coming out from what we had identified since the days of President Eisenhower as the military-industrial complex in the West. Today, Britain calls itself Global Britain and is pushing the pouring of weapons into Ukraine like mad. But step back a second. First of all, NATO became obsolete in 1991 when the Soviet Union disbanded. And what is required, the solution, is a new security architecture involving all of Europe, based on the principles of the Treaty of Westphalia of 1648, which ended massive religious warfare in Europe. The principle of diplomacy in a seemingly intractable situation is nations acting for the benefit of the other. I don't believe that President Biden wants a war with Russia. The American people don't want a war with Russia. And it's imperative that the United States...
What does he want then? What does he want when you say that? When you say Biden doesn't want a war with Russia, what does he want? Because it sure smells like one.
Not necessarily. If you look at the transcripts and the videos, the media continually attempts to goad him make provocative statements against Russia, and he keeps saying, we'll see a little bit, I'm not sure. I want to stress to you that there are significant forces in the United States, typified by former Ambassador Matlock to Russia, former Ambassador Chas Freeman to Saudi Arabia, former CIA Chief Graham Fuller in Afghanistan, who have all been calling very, very loudly and vociferously for a pullback of the U.S. offensive against Russia and calling for accepting the very recent proposals of the Russian Federation. Similarly, in Europe, many, many, many nations and leaders are saying this has to be slowed down.
Okay, let's get into that. I was going to get into that a little bit later, but Don DeBar, you had this interesting document which the U.S. decided not to release the details. It's very confusing as to the way that the U.S. approached this, not wanting to make it public, and for Russia to make parts of it public. But basically, I don't know if you saw that press conference where you had the U.S. Secretary of State presenting this document and saying, we're offering Russia a roadmap. But it sounded like it was a roadmap for the U.S. and not for Russia, because none of Russia's demands were met. But, of course, he didn't want to come out and say that, Anthony Blinken. At the same time, he was very vociferous when it came to how much weapons they're giving Ukraine, how their allies, U.S. allies in the Baltic states, for example, that are going to be getting more weapons. It's almost as if the U.S. had the gun down Russia's throat, saying, if you don't follow what we are proposing, then this is what you're going to get. Did you get that impression?
Well, I saw the press conference. What he delivered was a reply document from the United States. There was one also that came from NATO. There were reply documents to a pair of proposals, again, one to the United States and one to NATO, that Russia delivered on December 17th of this past year. And it wasn't a roadmap. He used the word roadmap here, from Blinken's mouth. I'm thinking of this image from the Johnny Carson show when they used to say a fake commercial, meet at the fork of the road, and there'd be an actual fork and then a bunch of squiggly lines behind it, a map that was useless to anyone trying to go anywhere. Russia laid out very plainly what the concerns are that they have, that they would like to negotiate a settlement, basically a global settlement with the United States and NATO, that you promised not to move your alliance up to our doorstep, in fact, not to even take military equipment into Eastern Germany at that time, East Germany, let alone into the Warsaw Pact countries, Poland, Czechoslovakia, the whole lot of them, Romania, Bulgaria. And so what happened instead was not only did they take most of the, and this was a point for Blinken, it's someone misspoke on a TV show on RT and said practically all instead of saying most, but almost every member of the Warsaw Pact is now a member of NATO, along with the three Baltic states, Lithuania, Latvia, and Estonia, and some other Soviet republics. And then on top of that, you had an attempted coup in each of Belarus and Kazakhstan that are clearly tied to the CIA. I mean, there's been millions, and there was $5 billion, according to Victoria Nuland from the U.S. State Department, Assistant Secretary of State for European Affairs, that was spent in the lead up to the Maidan coup, basically developing the communications infrastructure, including three TV stations that were used during the. This kind of thing has been going on in all of the old Soviet republics around Russia and in East Europe. And so Russia is seeing this, and they're seeing the troops that they fought when Germany invaded rolling in with being greeted by the locals, realizing the troops are being placed there for them.
Well, what's interesting about Richard Black, is the fact that in some cases we're looking at a Europe that has been somewhat conspicuously absent from the talks. I mean, remember the talks the week before where you had Wendy Sherman doing the negotiations with the Russian envoy at that point, and then there were news that it was the U.S. that was making the bidding for Europe, but not all European countries are on board. Why is it that Europe is not present, not actively present, when it comes to the talks?
Well, it is absolutely the case that there's a process that has emerged in Europe in which within many, many of NATO countries, the answer to war with Russia over Ukraine is absolutely no. Croatia has said we will not send troops. The Hungarian foreign minister is saying we need to negotiate long-term energy deals with Russia. Macron just had a long conversation yesterday with President Putin. President Putin just had a seminar with leading Italian industrialists earlier in the week, and a new one is being set up between German industrialists who want peace with Russia, a new video conference with President Putin. So in fact, it is the case that there, Blinken is lying, that there is a great deal of light between the positions of the nations of Europe and the United States, and Europe knows that it will go up in a nuclear holocaust, since it is the host to American nuclear weapons, if there's a war between, and let us be clear, we're talking about the possibility of a nuclear war between the United States and Russia. That's what's at stake here. And as I said earlier, I don't believe the U.S. Commander-in-Chief, this is my view, the Schiller Institute's view, it's not our view that the President, the Commander-in-Chief, President Biden, wants a nuclear war with Russia, and that's what's at stake.
Mm-hmm. Well, given that that's what's at stake, maybe that's why you're having these Eastern Ukraine talks, as it's called, Donbas, in which Russia, Ukraine, Germany, and France are voicing support for what it seems like a ceasefire, maintaining a ceasefire.
Yes.
And this kind of is like the negotiations that were called the Normandy talks. Maybe you can take us back, because it sounds an awful lot like the year 2014, when you had the Ukraine crisis, in a sense, break out, and then there were these talks. What were the Normandy talks? Are they feasible? Are those talks feasible to lay groundwork for a ceasefire? This will be for Donbas. Go ahead, Donbas. I'm sorry.
Okay.
Get back to you.
Say Normandy, there's actually an agreement, the Minsk agreements. And the Minsk agreement was, in essence, the key parts of it, that the Eastern Ukraine republics, particularly, I believe, Donetsk and Lugansk, I don't remember if the third one was a part of the agreement as to this part of the deal, they would become autonomous within, you know, the state of Ukraine. They would be autonomous governments, and this would resolve the contradiction between Kiev and the people that live in the east, in essence, because the domestic political situation in Ukraine is fragmented. It has been for, you know, a very long time. The people in the east are ethnic Russians. The people in the west are a composite of ethnic Poles, Lithuanians, you know, and others from, you know, more or less Western Europe. You have the whole, you know, historic schism between the Orthodox and the Roman Catholic world. Kind of that's a fracture line also that runs right through it. And the cultures that have evolved over many years. And by the way, most of Ukraine in both of those spheres, up until the last century for sure or so, were part of Russia for centuries. And so there are many contradictions on the ground that represent political constituencies, for example, that Zelensky has to deal with. Like Zelensky came in, he was elected as a peacemaker. He was going to resolve this dispute between the West and the East. And he got elected despite that fact, not because of it, in the West, because he was a TV star. And I think that's why he was chosen as a candidate. Once mm-hmm. he got in, he has a balancing act with these constituencies on the ground.
Sure.
And there is a very strong fascist element that has a very strong shock troop on the ground constituent that he has to deal with. And the United States is using that as sort of a forward guard to intimidate Russia, and it's really dangerous the way that's playing out. I'm just going to go to one last little point. In the 1962 Cuban Missile Crisis, as it's called here, which is actually because the U.S. put missiles in Turkey in 1961, that when Kennedy did that, everybody involved, Robert McNamara, Fidel Castro, Khrushchev in his memoirs, tell you that it was sheer luck that we didn't have nuclear war. We're playing now, it literally, Russian roulette, firing another shot and hoping the chamber is empty.
Uh-huh.
And I don't know Joe Biden, no matter what his intentions are, is up to it the way that John Kennedy was. And that's what we're gambling with right now.
Gambling. Russian roulette. Richard Black, provocations. This is very similar, in a sense, to what the U.S. is doing when it comes to the South China Sea and the way it's provoking China. I'm not too sure what foreign policy structure or plans the U.S. has by being involved in these big, what looks like adventures. Maybe you can tell us what is going on here. because, you know, Russia and China, obviously these are big powers.
I think you probably know the answer to the question, which is that there's a faction in the Republican and Democratic Party and in the U.S. media as a whole, which wants the United States to be the world hegemon. And in the West, there's a very deep, deep global financial crisis. Hyperinflation is out of control. The debt structure in the entire West is a disaster. And what they're proposing as a solution is continued massive hyperinflation to keep the bubble going, and the Green New Deal to get the world, including Iran, to get out of fossil fuels and out of nuclear. China is not accepting this. Russia is not accepting this. So China and Russia are both targets of this war faction in the West, which is proceeding out of desperation. At the same time, I would make the point that a new strategic element in the world as a whole is this unique collaboration now between China and Russia. They are inseparable from the standpoint of economic policy, development policy, strategic policy, and therefore, in the West, those who would push the West towards war may be facing war against Russia and China simultaneously, and this hopefully will function as a wise deterrent.
Okay, Don DeBar, my last question to you quickly, if you can. The Chinese ambassador to the U.S. issued a warning, possible military conflict over Taiwan. So my question, what are the chances of the U.S. being involved in a military confrontation with China compared to one with Russia?
He wants Jimmy the Greek, not me. listen, that faction that Richard speaks of, by the way, exists. The faction is called Congress, the White House, Langley, the Pentagon, the Supreme Court, every other institution of power that the United States has, and the media. That is the war faction in this thing, the one that wants hegemony. There does not seem to be a constituency outside of the political forces organized around Trump and maybe somewhat around Sanders that are even willing to consider the possibility of a multipolar world rather than this hegemonic one that they've been striving for certainly since 1991. But 1991 is really a product of the striving before that.
Okay, thank you very much for that. Don DeBar, journalist and political activist there, and a radio host from
Asana.
Richard Black, I'm sorry we're fresh out of time. Representative to the UN from the Schiller Institute, who spoke to us from Hackensack, New Jersey. We'll